Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner, StubHub, has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.
Hello, and welcome to the TIFO Football Podcast. I'm Joe Devine, and I'm joined now by Alex Stewart.
Good morning, Joe.
And Seb Stafford-Bloor.
Hi, Joe.
Hello. We're going to chat broad themes today, teams including Everton-Liverpool, Man City-Arsenal, Spurs-West Ham. That's where the teams end. But it's going to be really good, and you know why, because we're good, and the football's good, so podcast good. Anyway, if you like other things that are good, you should visit theathletic.com/TIFO to enjoy all of the good work that The Athletic does. Of course, that is editorial pieces with journalists dedicated to individual clubs in the Premier League. Of course, there are some Champions League clubs in there too. We have 10 other sports, lots of journalists in America. I think there's something like 400 journalists overall, maybe just slightly fewer than that. But it's a lot of people writing wonderful, wonderful stories, and particularly a lot of long reads for you to become really very well acquainted with the sport that you love. I don't think that's a a verified marketing line. But it's quite good, isn't it? Well acquainted. Huh? Do we like that?
We do.
Maybe I should send an internal fax to the marketing department. Hey, well acquainted. Yeah. I have nothing else to say. Does anyone want to say anything else before we get started?
No.
All right. A lot of enthusiasm this morning. I will leave you in the cold hands and the cold embrace of myself. Let us begin, dear friends, with Manchester City and Arsenal. Now, of course, Manchester City and Arsenal played each other over the last weekend. Alex, I just want to put this to you. We talked about it a bit at the time, but something that frustrated me enormously whilst watching that game was the way in which, and I normally love Jamie Carragher, and, you know, this, I don't really, not trying to level a criticism. This isn't a dig. I'm not trying to start a beef. But he just kept saying that the players were freewheeling. I mean, players from both teams, Manchester City and Arsenal, of course, there were some jokes towards the beginning of the game. I'm worried it was Gary Neville and not Jamie Carragher. I can't remember which one. They're the same. They made these jokes about, whoa, where's the right back starting? Are they in the middle? And is there a winger that's cutting inside, as if these things have never happened before ever? And this is the first time teams have, you know, had unusual formations or players that fulfill more than one role or do more than one thing. It's never happened before, ever, never. And they kept sort of making jokes about, no one could predict it. We didn't know what's going to, you know, the players are freewheeling. They're not freewheeling. They've been told what to do. They've been told what to do by coaches that tell them exactly what to do and are renowned for telling them exactly what to do. Can you just explain that a little better than I have done, please? Because it's very annoying.
I think you've explained it quite cogently. Yes, I mean, it's so that obviously that Manchester City formation is a sort of kind of a 3-5-2, possibly. If you actually look at the average position in the passing map, that, you know, Kyle Walker, for example, starting as a right-sided centre-back, is pretty much in a kind of right back slot. Cancelo is kind of playing further up the pitch almost as a wide right sided player. So it's not, you know, the starting formation for a start is not necessarily how things manifest, particularly when a team is in possession. It's much more of an indicator of how teams are in a kind of defensive position, usually mostly in a sort of mid or low block. So that's the first thing to say, that, you know, don't look at the formation and think this is what the team is going to look like on the pitch all of the time. The second thing to say, exactly like you said, is that, you know, these teams don't freewheel generally, because that's just not how it works. And you're dealing here with Guardiola and Arteta, with two coaches who espouse the philosophy of positional play, which is highly orchestrated. We've talked about positional play a number of times. We talked about it on the State of the Club tactics segment, for example. You know, there are a set number of rules about where players should be, that there shouldn't be more than, you know, three players on the same vertical line, two on the same horizontal line, or is it the other way around? I can never remember. That, you know, if a player is in a particular zone and leaves that zone, then another player has a move into that zone, that you know, everybody moves around the pitch in an orchestrated fashion with these repetitious movements that are learned and practiced, and that's why tight control and spacing is so important.
Freewheeling.
And it's kind of basically the opposite of freewheeling.
I mean, couldn't be further from freewheeling. That's what makes it so irritating. It's in the middle. It's the total opposite of freewheeling.
Yeah, I mean, I assume we're all taking freewheeling to mean the same kind of thing here, which is a sort of improvisation of position and so on.
The wheel is free.
But that is simply not what these coaches do. And I guess the point to make here maybe is a slightly wider, you know, I think Gary Neville and Jamie Carragher have done an awful lot for the comprehension of tactics and the explanation of tactics with Monday Night Football. And they should be lauded for that. But by and large, there is still a deficit with commentators. And I appreciate that it's difficult if you're, you know, doing co-commentary and you're there to provide that kind of additional tactical input while a game's going on. It can be very hard to do that, I'm sure. But tactics is complicated. It's pushed on a lot. You know, there are concepts now which exist that are understood by some of an audience. And I think there's a deficit in how well some commentators explain that stuff. And there can be a kind of a resetting to a position of lots of guys running around doing stuff that's a bit wild. That simply doesn't reflect the reality.
Do you know what as well? I think Alex and I went to an Opta event once in West London somewhere. It was basically just a series of talks. And a bit of networking. But one of the special guests that was there at that event was Danny Murphy. And I remember thinking beforehand when...
just the idea of the two of you networking.
Well, no, when I say like Alex and I were stood outside smoking while everyone else was having a nice time and talking to each other.
That just sounds like it would have been horrendous for my company.
It doesn't work. It doesn't work at all.
It's maybe the only if we time got we ever own. Got asked.
Yeah. Have you got any cigarettes? Yeah, here you go. That's pretty much it. Anyway, the point I was making was, what was I saying? Oh, yes, Danny Murphy was on the bill. And I remember thinking, you know, beforehand, like the sort of cruel and belligerent man that I am, Danny Murphy, an Opta event, what the fuck is happening? You know, it's like, it doesn't make any sense. Danny Murphy is an idiot. Danny Murphy doesn't understand what, you know, stats are. Of course Danny Murphy understands. So we get there, watch the talk, and there I am, foolish old me, being shown right up by Danny Murphy, who clearly, very, very clearly grasps, a lot of the modern metrics that are being used today, and has a sharp tactical understanding for the game. I can't remember. I won't quote him because I can't remember exactly what he said. But it was something along the lines of, "I have to change the way that I watch football when I appear on Match of the Day because I'm appealing to a broad audience and not to Joe and Alex from TIFO." He didn't say that last bit, but I just remember thinking, like, I do. It makes me wonder, like, how much direction there is in not specifically the commentary but in the punditry around football as well, how much they are supposed to, I mean, essentially, I shouldn't be using this term, but dumb down their view of football for a broad audience. Does that make me sound smug enough for you, Seb?
Yeah, I think so, but I think it's a fair way of describing it.
Well, what do you think when you watch football and hear the commentators and hear the punditry? Because you've met probably a few of these people as well, and you will know presumably that they've got more in the locker than they're showing you on their Saturday.
Yeah, well, I think the key distinction to draw is between the BBC and Sky Sports and their different objectives, because the BBC is supposed to cater to as broad an audience as possible, whereas Sky Sports is, of course, a dedicated sports channel. And the tone of the coverage reflects that. So I don't think it's unfair, but I think also the BBC's coverage tends generally to be bent through the lens of Match of the Day, which is a highlights programme. The utility is that, well, the function of Match of the Day is to literally provide highlights, a catch-up. It's the traditional role of the Saturday highlight show, whereas obviously if you want your deeper dives, you're going to go to... you're going to go to Sky Sports, you're going to go to the internet, or you're going to go to TIFO on YouTube. But I think it's very easy for people to make this mistake because there is so much football on TV, and the personalities associated with it often appear in, you know, several different positions. And I've got a great deal of sympathy for Danny Murphy, actually, because you are expected to alter your, I suppose, character depending on where you're appearing. So that's actually, I mean, it's a bit of a skill. Totally. One I admire, but it's,
well, this is what I'm saying. This is why I say I came away from that event with a huge amount of respect for him, because I had kind of foolishly or naively not realised that there was more to the job than just talking about football.
There is an element where, so Sky Sports is a product, an entertainment product, and part of the entertainment, in inverted commas, is the personality of some of the pundits, because people will say or do things that will attract coverage. Roy Keane will roll his eyes and it will become a gif. And, you know, I think that there's always a balance between, you know, when Carragher and Neville are on Monday Night Football, their job is to provide insight. And I think they do that.
Yeah.
But around the match day, where stuff is kind of hyped and there's narratives to explore, there is a transition there. And so if the narrative of Guardiola against Arteta is sort of master against pupil and this incredibly complicated ornate style of football, and, you know, it's assume it's relatively easy to fall into the trap of kind of engaging in hyperbole to describe that and then turning it into, well, they're just going to be all over the place and the formation will be insane and they'll do this, that and the other, and that's partly because that's the kind of the hype and the narrative that surrounds that fixture. But I suspect that if that fixture was then analysed, you would have had those same pundits making considerably more astute points about it in the course of the game.
You're probably right. And don't get me wrong. I really like both of them. I think they do a very good job. I just thought I would like to point out, actually, I think there's you're right. Maybe it's where it's being pitched. I don't mind the Roy Keane, Graham Souness stuff, the kind of silly take on football stuff, because I sort of think, well, yeah, what's the point otherwise? That's what football's there for, as far as I understand it, for people to have, you know, meaningless conversations and, you know, have ridiculous takes that are completely unnecessary and about something that just doesn't matter at all. That's fine. That's the point of football.
Why is that the point of football?
Because what else would be the point of football?
To understand it?
Well, yeah, but to understand what? Or, I mean, there's no point, is there? What's the point in understanding it? It's irrelevant. It doesn't matter. It doesn't help anything. So, like, what's the point in understanding it? I think everything we do is wrong. I think we should just be doing hot takes on, you know, oh, he's rubbish at the game. The point is, it's for social cohesion, isn't it? It's for community. And what does the community love more than a good chat about football? Often those chats don't involve learning anything about it. I mean, I think personally, that's exactly what football is for. What I don't like is when football is not being discussed in that realm. I.e., it's been discussed in a kind of more educational realm, like the commentators, whose job is not to, you know, do gossip or whatever, but to actually commentate on the game, and then is inaccurate. That's just irritating. But I don't mind all of the kind of stuff around it. Do you understand what I'm saying, Seb?
I do. And also, I don't think this weekend was a really good example of this. I know we're going to talk about Liverpool-Everton a little bit later, but I thought, I don't much care for the substance of what Graham Souness says, but character he plays on TV it's very similar to the average fan watching at home. So if you look at the conversation, if you look at his punditry immediately after the game, he's talking about Jordan Pickford, and he's given a overly emotional, ludicrous response to what was just, you know, a really unfortunate accident. And then you had Carragher on the other end of what seemed to be a kind of badly connected Zoom with a little bit of a delay, saying, "Oh, behave, Graham." It's a very authentic segment.
Because he's got his finger on the pulse of the viewers, man. Like, he chimes with what as you say, many people already think.
Well, if you look at kind of the social media output associated with that game in the days since, with this coming out on Thursday, so a couple of days removed, but last 48 hours, there have been some ridiculous things said about Jordan Pickford to the point where his family is supposedly receiving death threats and that kind of thing. It's terrible. And I think what was quite interesting about Souness is he captured the kind of the hypocrisy of the modern fan in a way, because there's Graham Souness, one of the nastiest players ever to play the game. And yeah. I mean, younger people that aren't aware of this, Google him. Google Graham Souness and have a look at some of the tackles that littered his career.
I think tackles overstates it, to be fair.
Yeah, well, even within the context of the rules back then and the slightly different nature in which the game was played and the way that modern referees protect players, to have someone get that bent out of shape about the idea of kind of putting another player in danger, it's just ludicrous. But then again, this is what we're all guilty of. We change our opinions depending on the shirt of the player that's either been hurt or, you know, is offside or has scored a goal or hasn't scored a goal. We're ruled by tribalism. And I think Souness is the same. I think he's part of that sort of standing army of ex-Liverpool players that kind of rise and march whenever there's an issue. And I think it is important to have that on TV. It's not what I like. It's not really for me, but it is for the majority, and it's a valuable dynamic, even if I personally don't appreciate it.
I don't appreciate it either. But then you know,
like me, and then you don't care about it.
That's kind of what Seb's saying.
That kind of apathy spills out into other departments of your life, Alex.
Yeah, okay, that's possibly fair. But no, I mean, it's the thing that most angers, or not even angers me, I just sort of roll my eyes at it, is this ridiculously partisan quality. And we've touched on it before, but you know, even to the extent where we can post a video asking if Team A is one of the best teams ever, and the responses are littered with people going, "Yeah, but what about this other team?" And it's like,
that's the point there. That's what football is, isn't it? That's kind of the point I'm trying to make.
I don't understand that.
But it's a space to be irrational. Like, it's a, it annoys me too. But it happens.
But it's fine there. That's the point. Like, so I hope the point you're about to make is the one I'm trying to lean towards, is that there's no, like, obviously, you know, obviously I do not mean when things take a turn, or when death threats are being sent to someone's family, or when violence spills over. But for the most part, with football fans, let's just call it in the UK for now, it is an opportunity to be irrational when, particularly as an adult, when you have responsibilities in your life, when every other moment of the day you have to be rational, when, you know, you spend a lot of money to participate in football and can only, you know, obviously only do it at the weekends, and you haven't got that much going on. And I mean, it's your opportunity to, I mean, let your hair down basically and just let yourself go to the irrationality. I find it too when I watch teams that I'm fonder of. I find often I get sort of drawn in to the, if there's a tackle on a player that I like, I might swear at the player who did the tackle, even if I know it's a mistake. Doesn't matter. I'm letting myself get caught up in it. Thus the point of football. Without that, I literally cannot understand what it would be for. I mean, I think it would be completely pointless without those irrationalities that you're describing, Alex.
Possibly, but I still get what you're saying, and I suppose this is just a difference with me personally, but I don't feel the need to have an irrationality.
That's because you've buried your anger deep down and the football isn't enough to get it out, you know?
Until now.
Maybe if you're watching your parents play football in the garden, that might trigger something. I don't know what that would be.
Yeah, my mum Graham Sounessing my dad. That would be quite funny.
Anyway, let's talk about a different thing after the break.
This episode is supported by season 3 of FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League 2 after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher division. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenges and rise again into League 1? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May 2nd on FX. Stream on Hulu.
Let's talk about... I want to talk about Spurs-West Ham. Because we sort of did Spurs the other day. We didn't really. We just did how Man United collapsed in front of Spurs. And clearly Spurs are pretty good, aren't they? Or are they? I mean, I don't know anymore. I'm so confused about it because they did the goals and then they conceded the goals. We did have our opportunity to see Gareth Bale, of course. There was a little more of Kane in the playmaking role, which I know Alex is keen to discuss. And of course, that Manuel Lanzini goal was bloody delightful, wasn't it, Seb?
Sure was. Although, so a little bit of a behind the curtain moment. I got on a plane at 3-0 Tottenham, and the plane landed about 3 minutes after full time.
It's a good band name, that is. I got on a plane at 3-0 Tottenham.
I turned my phone on to aeroplane mode when I got on. It was 3-0. I remember thinking all the way through the flight, it wasn't a long one, but it was, I remember thinking, being weirdly anxious because with a 3-0 lead. And it's because Tottenham haven't kept a clean sheet all season. And not even in the Europa League qualifiers when they literally play teams that I've never heard of, with players I've never heard of, who really weren't very good and still... somehow, even though they progressed and scored goals at the other end of the pitch and did enough to get through, these games were still littered with awful defensive moments. And I feel like this has been lost in the reaction, because it was everything we know about Spurs. Are they better going forward? Are they a bit more interesting? Yes, they are. And Alex has just written an excellent script on, which is going to explain part of that, which will be coming out in the next few days. But at the same time, has this kind of defensive collapse, these defensive issues, have they been part of Jose Mourinho's reign for the last almost a year, for 11 months? Absolutely. It's actually very similar, with some neat symmetry, very similar to the first game he took charge of, which was against West Ham at London Stadium. Spurs into a 3-goal lead, and they won the game 3-2, but had the game gone on for an extra 5 minutes, that would also have finished 3-2.
There's been a lot of 3-2s with Spurs, hasn't there?
Yeah, they just can't defend. I mean, and also that defence for a while. So what's happened, obviously, since the breakup of Pochettino's original defence, which, of course, was Alderweireld, Vertonghen, Danny Rose and Kyle Walker, what they've done is, as different members of that group have either left the club or fallen out of favour or got older, they've tried to replace them individually. What the group actually needs is, in my opinion, it needs to be rethought of collectively. So you need to... Instead of just trying to plug the gap that results in Toby Alderweireld's lack of pace, you need to look at a different structure. Instead of buying a Serge Aurier to replace Kyle Walker because they're vaguely similar in the sense of how they act beyond the halfway line, you need to look at the defence's balance. And there are all sorts of... I mean, I don't want to pick on Davinson Sanchez, but it's as if the reaction to his performance is as if this is a new thing. Davinson Sanchez has been pretty poor for about 18 months, 2 years. People forget this because he was bought for a lot of money and he came from Ajax, and he still has a very good reputation. Some of his individual moments for Spurs over the last couple of seasons, it's just been abysmal at times. He's had good games. I'm not saying he's a useless player, but these are not new themes. That's my point. And there has been no general correction to the way Tottenham defend, or the little irritations like Hugo Lloris's inability to come off his line, or his weird susceptibility to long shots. Lovely goal by Manuel Lanzini. Fabulous hit. Brilliant.
Yeah.
Lloris should be saving that. He goes, if we had David Priest on this pod,
didn't he?
Yeah, if we had David Priest on this pod, he'd be saying, right, you're going with your wrong hand. You are covering the space between... between him and his top corner, it looked wrong. And if you go back, Lloris is a goalkeeper who makes a lot of really good saves, but concedes a lot of goals which aren't necessarily glaring mistakes, but which you think, that looks a little bit soft. And I think soft is the way you describe all the different parts of that defense. It's bad defending set pieces. It's vulnerable between the fullbacks and centre halves in that little channel. It gets turned around far too easily. Players who sit and screen in front of it give the ball away in stupid positions and never seem to learn the mistakes and learn from those mistakes. And it's kind of one of the reasons why it's quite difficult to blame Mourinho for it, because these things have roots in the Pochettino era too. They've been going on for that long.
Well, this is what I was going to ask, though. I mean, like, Jose Mourinho is a renowned defensive coach. He's a coach who's renowned for coming in and sorting out teams with defensive frailties. Are you saying simply that the issue is with individual errors and there's nothing you can do about it?
No, I'm not recusing him entirely. I think there's definitely a case for saying this defense needs to be rebuilt from the ground up. The reason I'm pausing on attacking Mourinho is, so Matt Doherty is in, Sergio Reguilon has come in, Joe Roden has been signed from Swansea City. There are new components here.
Yeah.
So I'm willing to say, let's give it a little bit of time to see what his vision for this defence is.
You're basically a convert, aren't you?
I'm
you've been etching towards
hard.
It for the last 8 weeks or so, and now you're just like, I feel like you're just basically a secret Mourinho fan.
I have always been. Nah. I'm trying very, very hard to be open-minded with Jose Mourinho because...
You're making it sound very easy.
It's tricky. I think there are times when, if you're a Tottenham fan, if you're honest, you would recognise themes from that West Ham game in Tottenham's play for the last 2 or 3 years.
Can I ask you a specific question then, right? Because, you know, talking about Graeme Souness before, talking about pulse of the nation, right? I want to test you as a kind of pulse of Spurs fans across the nation.
Okay.
You know, when we started this season, which really was only, what, 2 months ago?
Five weeks ago.
5 weeks ago? Was that really it? Maybe we're talking about the end of last season then. At some point this year, you vehemently hated Jose Mourinho, right? We had several conversations about it. You thought he was a terrible, terrible choice. I think it was actually, it might have been the discussion after that Everton game. You know, it's not that you didn't rate him previously as a manager, but you did not rate him now as a manager for this Spurs team in this situation. And over the last 5-6 weeks, I know you're probably just going to say it's the results, but you've definitely pivoted on that position. And I wonder if you are similar to many Spurs fans. Can you just walk us through what's happened to you?
Resignation, I think, because there are a couple of realities with Jose Mourinho. I still don't think he's the right choice. I still would have placed 5 or 6 managers in Europe above him for this position.
Who?
Well, I think there should have been a more of an attempt to look at sort of a Marco Rosa. Nagelsmann was probably off the table. Hasenhüttl is one I would have looked at. I know that's going to antagonise Alex, but there's a lot about Southampton that I really like. Nuno Santo at Wolves.
Yeah.
Before he signed his new contract, I liked a lot of what he did. I mean, I know this won't be received particularly well, but and would have been impractical because
Neil Warnock.
I was going to say Eddie Howe actually, but that seems a bit silly given what happened to Bournemouth. But I still think there's a very decent future manager in Eddie Howe. I think what's happened is that I've been pleasantly surprised by the club's ambition in the transfer market. Which I don't think many people saw coming, because I think when Jose Mourinho walks through the front door at your club, you think he's only going to succeed if he's supported with big outlays, big signings. And I don't think any Tottenham supporter would have thought we're going to see a player of Reguilon's quality. I don't think anybody really imagined that Gareth Bale was going to come back.
Do you think Daniel Levy just got bored of doing the same thing for 16 years or whatever?
I don't know. I mean, I'm not sure what the mechanics of this sort of... about turn are, but it's made a difference. And the other thing is that I'm kind of sick of hearing myself saying negative things about Mourinho, because he's here. Like it's just, there's nothing new to say. All the grievances.
You've spoken yourself redundant.
I think I have. I think I've talked myself out, because I think, you know, all the reservations I have with him are going to be the same next week as they were last week and the week before and the week before that. The reality at Spurs is that he is on a very large contract. He's not going anywhere. So you might as well try and see the positives from it, because it's just a little bit more interesting. And so trying to identify progress or things, you know, in more simple terms, things that are changing and evolving, it's just a little bit more interesting and compelling as a supporter. So my reaction to the West Ham game wasn't the kind of the raging fury that we've seen elsewhere, because I kind of expected it. Maybe not a 3-0, but I don't trust this Tottenham side to defend Leeds, whatever those leads may be. And actually, if you look at, I mean, I watched the game in its entirety, already knowing the result, so sort of a dispassionate perspective. But if you watch that game, especially that first half again, and the kind of the opening sort of 10, 15 minutes of the second half, yeah, I mean, I don't think Tottenham were, I don't think it's quite as simple as saying Tottenham were really good for 85 minutes and then, you know, fucked it. It's just not the case at all. They had a good 20 minutes, a very indifferent hour, and then a really bad 10 minutes. It's really not more complicated.
I agree. I felt really bad for West Ham during that game because I
felt
like
they didn't deserve to be three down.
No, not at all. And actually, the commentary again, not to just be that person that moans on about the commentary. I don't mean to do that, but I found it very dispiriting, particularly if I was a West Ham supporter watching that, because the commentary kept reminding me that West Ham had had a terrible game, and I just didn't correlate with what I'd seen at all. I mean, obviously they'd had a bad first few minutes, and you know, some severe defensive wobbles, which resulted in three goals. But also, not to take away from Spurs, those goals were excellent goals. They were difficult to defend goals, right? So it's not the end of the world. It feels like it when you get to 3-0 down. But Spurs, the constant sort of a commentary line of Spurs was that they were in cruise control. And they weren't at all.
No,
they were in cruise control in the sense that they were 3-0 up most of the game. That's sort of cruise control. You've got a big, you know, there's a big space between you and drawing or losing, right? Which obviously inevitably they managed to do. But in terms of controlling the game, having more possession, looking more dominating while they were playing, making better passes, creating more chances, just looking more confident, they didn't do any of those things. And I kept watching it thinking, am I sort of falling asleep for moments of this, or am I completely misunderstanding what's happening in front of my eyes? Are West Ham being done a disservice here? In some ways, I think it was worth it for them to score three goals and come back in that game just to prove the weird commentary team wrong.
I think what you've landed on there is the privilege of having world-class attacking players.
Yeah, they score goals. Yeah,
that score goals, because you're not reliant on team performance. You're reliant on little combinations between those players, which give the illusion of authority within a game, or you know, at least the idea that you know, Tottenham were hugely superior to West Ham in the first half. I don't think they were. Watching it back again, like with a caveat that you know, I watched it after I knew the result, but it was a full sense of security. And so nothing that happened off that, especially off the first goal went in. You could see it. You could see it in the way that Tottenham defended. Nothing's really changed without the ball in terms of the ability to defend their own box. I mean, Mourinho's literally placed more players in the box, but the quality of the actions of those players hasn't improved. It's just the only real improvement, I'd say, two areas. Kane and Son, that combination has changed and become much more dynamic and effective. It's been wonderful to watch. And Tanguy Ndombele has improved immeasurably.
Yeah,
he has
definitely
reconditioned himself. I think beyond that, you know, Reguilón's played very well, but you know, early days there. Beyond that, I don't see much which is there's not much cause for enthusiasm in many of the other systems at the moment. Some good results, but it's not, I don't know. It's a really good example of what happens, of narrative, isn't it? This is what the score says, so therefore this is what my reaction must be. Like when I got off the plane, like I caught up with the WhatsApp conversation between you and Alex, and one of Alex's comments was, well, it's been a bit boring apart from the six goals. And I thought that was kind of Alex being Alex with his, you know, the way he looks at games. But then I watched the game back and he was right. And I think that's kind of indicative of, you know, the illusion of goal scoring and, you know, individual players having an influence versus, you know, an actual, you know, properly performing football team.
Well, Alex, I would say I'd like to talk about West Ham a little bit, who, as I said before, I thought actually weren't bad during the game. A couple of things that I noticed were the link-up play between Fornals and Antonio was actually very delicate at times and quite nice, particularly in the first half, and then obviously improving into the second. Also, Suchek is big, isn't he? Isn't he big?
Yeah. There's a couple of points just very quickly to throw back to Lloris, which I think is interesting. Last season, his post-shot expected goals plus or minus. Do we know what that is? Shall I explain what that is?
That's the number of goals that he should or shouldn't. It's like goalkeeper XG, right?
Yeah, basically. Yeah. So he was second best in the Premier League last season by volume and best by per 90.
Which means he saved more than he should have done.
He saved 7.3 goals more than he should have done based on the post-shot XG, yeah.
Which either suggests he was lucky or he's a good goalkeeper.
Correct. Whereas okay. this season, he is the second lowest.
Oh, with, so he was lucky.
Minus 2.3. So maybe he was lucky, maybe he's not being protected as well, but it's worth saying that he, you know, the point I would make is that it's entirely possible that actually Spurs' defensive issues last season were slightly ameliorated by an overperformance by a goalkeeper, and things could have been significantly worse had he performed at average. And in terms of that game, yeah, I mean, Seb's absolutely right. Like, although Spurs created slightly more chances, West Ham outshot them. West Ham had more accurate passes in the opposition half. West Ham had more accurate crosses. Like, this was an even game. And I think in terms of how the end result came about, yes, obviously, if you have a massive swing in one direction followed by a massive swing in the other, it's hard to read off that. But actually, during the course of the game, I think Seb's spot on. You know, Spurs were not, by any stretch of the imagination, dominant. And a lot of that was to do with how West Ham played. I think Antonio's a really interesting player. You know, he's a converted right wing back, effectively.
Yeah.
Who has also played in wide attacking positions and kind of been recast as a centre forward, largely, I think, on the basis of the fact that he is exceptionally good in the air. And, you know, going back a number of seasons, he was the Premier League's highest scorer off headers quite consistently.
Not this season.
No, but it's
old
a big
DCL's
vote
in town, eh?
Yes. It's a big vote of faith in him because obviously, you know, West Ham's sort of marquee signing in the last window was Sebastian Haller coming off a fantastic season with Eintracht Frankfurt as a pretty complete all-round modern forward, but one who was, you know, supposed to be aerially dominant. And the fact that he just hasn't worked out at West Ham so far and Antonio's got that spot is a real vote of confidence in him. But he, I think probably because he started life elsewhere on the pitch, his link-up play is very good. You know, he's an astute mover with the ball and he drags defenders with him because of this aerial threat. And that allows West Ham's other attacking players to push forwards into space. I thought Yarmolenko was good when he came on as well. Cresswell is a danger both from open play but also from set piece delivery. And Suchek is a fantastic signing. I mean, I think what's interesting as well with that West Ham midfield is that Declan Rice is a different player for West Ham than he is for England, and that there are various reasons for that, I'm sure, that are not just, you know, in terms of who he's playing with, the role and responsibility that he has. But at West Ham, he's able to carry the ball forwards a little bit more because I think Suchek is a genuine box-to-box midfielder who can cover behind Rice and allow Rice to progress the ball a bit better, which he doesn't really have at England. You know, for England, his role is supposed to be much more, you know, screening and focused on not really moving. So I think the balance of West Ham is looking pretty good at the moment.
I like it anyway. Happy for them. Also, I always like Aaron Cresswell is my new Jesse Lingard in the sense that I go, how old is he? Sorry? I thought, isn't Aaron Cresswell supposed to be forever young? That forever young sort of exciting, establishing West Ham left back. And now he's 31 in December. I thought he was like 25. And he was going to get his move to a bigger club.
What I will say about West Ham is they've got Manchester City this weekend. Just hold the phone a little bit until...
Hey, no one's picking up the phone, Seb. We're holding the phone.
Hold the phone indeed. Well,
don't let it, no, hold
what
on.
Does
no,
hold
actually,
the phone mean?
Don't
it means...
No,
let's,
no, stop.
Let's just pause on them because historically...
We're not saying anything definitive. We're just saying that West Ham have been better so far. Stop trying to spoil the West Ham joy by thinking, oh, difficult things are coming up in the future. Therefore, we shouldn't be excited about nice things that have happened in the past. What about this? It's my wedding day, Mother. Yes, it is, son. But don't be excited because one day you're going to die.
Yeah, but you see, a Stoic would say that the realization of that as a kind of logical outcome
just
is
stop.
The thing that...
Okay. No, no. We're going to leave West Ham there. We're leaving West Ham where they're happy because they came back and beat Spurs, then basically beat Spurs. They didn't beat Spurs. They drew 3-3. It was a tremendous game
victory.
Of football. It was a moral victory. And actually, it was certainly a moral victory over the commentary team. We're leaving it there. After the break, we'll come back and talk about Everton and Liverpool. Everton and Liverpool. Everton and Liverpool.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Okay, Everton and Liverpool, what is the talking point here? Alex's plan says the talking point here is key men. And that's the only intro I'm giving you, Alex. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, obviously, there's been significant brouhaha over the Virgil van Dijk injury. And they are currently missing Alisson as well. And I suppose what's interesting is the degree to which Liverpool were a good team but a work in progress. Until those two signings happened, Van Dijk first, Alisson second, the extent to which, you know, Van Dijk being out arguably for the rest of the season probably, and Alisson, I don't know, has probably got another couple of months left, to what extent that hurts them and how much, you know, that it's possible to work out. Obviously Liverpool's front three are really, really good. But you do know what you're getting with them. It's just very hard to stop that because they're such technically excellent players. But the weakness at the back that was solved by those two very expensive but very astute acquisitions, Liverpool losing them, is that effectively the title over? I know that's quite a kind of narrative.
But the thing is, they bought them in, that was the title won. I mean, that's kind of the point you're making, isn't it? Like, it seemed as simple as that from a to B, so why wouldn't it be from B to A?
I mean, I think the caveat I'd add is that you know, Fabinho has played as a centre-back and excelled in a game. I can't remember who it was against, but he was really good. Was it
He
Everton?
Was good in that game. I think it was Arsenal, wasn't it?
Yes, sorry, Arsenal, yes, not Everton, that was who they played at the weekend. And obviously they've now got Thiago, who's back and recovered, who can play, albeit as a much less physical six, but brings that kind of intelligence and screening. So there may be a case to say that Liverpool can adapt. I still think Adrian, obviously, is a significant downgrade on Alisson, not just because Alisson's one of the world's best goalkeepers, but because Liverpool's approach of having this very high line, which again Van Dijk you know, facilitates, and I do think Fabinho is reasonable cover in that sense, but Adrian is not the same as Alisson in terms of sweeping up behind that back line and his ability to play through the first line of the press. I think it's, you know, the title may have been decided, although it's also hard to say who's significantly better.
Decided it's... to go to who? Because I think Man City have had a pretty ropey start as well, haven't they?
Yeah, it's... I mean, will West it Ham. Be Everton? Yeah, West Ham.
West Ham or Brighton, one of the two. Everton, maybe, yeah.
I don't know. It's just... It's interesting to see, you know, obviously the reaction to the Van Dijk injury has been, as we've sort of discussed earlier, has verged from the ridiculous to the obscene. But I think it's indicative of just how important he is and how much Liverpool fans realise that, you know, that the title was built on his ability to do certain things.
Yeah.
And there is a real paucity of, genuinely top-class defenders. I think Carragher said this during the Spurs game, actually, when he was talking about how bad Davinson Sanchez had been. But it seems like, you know, the two key positions in modern football are centre-back and defensive midfielder, and there just aren't that many that are really, really good. And Liverpool are going to have to compensate for the absence of one by dropping arguably one of the world's best DMs back into centre-back, probably. And that's going to really hurt them.
Well, I would say that my perception on this slightly changed. We were chatting about it last night because the outpouring of I suppose, support and
grief.
Sometimes kind of, yeah, verging on grief over Virgil van Dijk was enough to pause for thought. He's 29 years old, isn't he? I didn't realise that. I thought he was a little younger. I thought he was closer to 27.
Do you just think all professional athletes are like 3 or 4 years younger than they actually are?
I think that's what it is, yeah. But anyway,
as
I thought
you're
he was
getting older.
I thought he was 3 or 4 years
passing.
Younger.
Yeah. We're all going to die.
The idea that Virgil van Dijk is younger than me anyway just seems ridiculous because people, I feel like older people should just get bigger and taller as they get older. So 90-year-olds should be, you know, basically giants. Virgil van Dijk is 29 years old. He's going to be out for probably the whole season, right? I mean, maybe not, but possibly as long as the entire season. It's also an injury which is difficult for players to recover from. It's also an injury which he's had before. Am I right in saying that, or he's had a significant layoff before, hasn't he, Seb?
He's certainly. I'm looking at his career statistics. I don't know anything about his injury history. Looking at his injury statistics, he's had a few seasons where he's missed a couple of games.
Oh, okay. Maybe I'm wrong. I don't think
he's had a cruciate ligament injury before.
I'm not sure if it was exactly the same one, but I thought he'd had some kind of lengthy layoff.
You keep
maybe
talking, and I shall look it up in the background.
Yeah.
It will kind of
irrelevant.
Take him into the period at which athletes pass their peak, though.
Well, this is kind of what I'm saying, and also it is because of what you described, Alex, that the nature of Liverpool's title win, the nature of Liverpool's team improvement after bringing in Alisson and Van Dijk, and also Van Dijk just being this kind of, you know, towering leadership figure.
Mm. Yeah, he's a genuine talisman for them.
He's genuinely, like, I think, you know, it's difficult. It's a difficult conversation often. Who is the best player in this position in the world? You've got Messi and Ronaldo. There's an argument about that. You've got players in all sorts of other positions. There's always an argument. With Virgil van Dijk, it really doesn't feel like there's an argument. It really feels like Virgil van Dijk is the best centre-back in the world. At 29, to miss a season just after you've won the Premier League with Liverpool and the Champions League the season before, it feels like not just missing a season, it feels like missing what could have been, or maybe you had the opportunity to be the best season of your life, or another at the very, very top of the game before some of the physical deterioration starts to come in just as a result, naturally, of the ageing process.
I think that's right. And I think it's worth saying that it's not just his defensive attributes that mark him out as being, if not the best in the sort of top three. His distribution is exceptional and is a huge part of how Liverpool play. I think what's also interesting is to go back to the sense of narrative. There was so much conversation around that Liverpool title win about how it was, and also the Champions League win the season before, about how it was because they'd brought Van Dijk in. And you just wonder to what degree not even fans, but possibly even members of the squad who had, you know, that squad is otherwise not significantly changed. I mean, Trent Alexander-Arnold was coming through or was well established in the Champions League season, but had basically come through the season previously. But there haven't been many significant additions otherwise. And that's a squad that always had high levels of quality going forwards, but they knew that they had a weakness at centre-back, and they knew that Van Dijk coming in had solved that, and the degree to which they'll then be thinking internally, like, you know, this is a huge problem. I mean, you know, Matip is good, but he's injury-prone. Gomez has positional difficulties. And then you're into, you know, a couple of quite young players, you know, none of whom have been massively impressive, or Fabinho.
I would pick up on that point as well and say that I think the way that the narrative will be written around last season, it was Klopp's trophy, right? It's Liverpool's Premier League, but it's Klopp's trophy. The second person whose trophy it is Virgil van Dijk. And this is in a team with Mo Salah, right? With Sadio Mane,
but
with Roberto Firmino.
Those guys had been there already, you know.
I think they'd won the season before. I feel like the Champions League victory the year prior was Mo Salah's year. The following year was much more about team play, and Virgil van Dijk just became the emblem for that. But that's a very hard thing to do in a team with that many superstars. So what I'm saying is, I suppose it's not just an ordinary injury. I do, obviously, you know, surprise, surprise, social media goes, over the top sometimes. That's not news to anybody, right? But there's an outpouring of emotion for a reason, because this is different than an ordinary injury. And I don't mean that to denigrate other players who perhaps aren't quite as good as Virgil van Dijk, or, you know, not as pivotal points in their career. Yeah. But losing Virgil van Dijk for a season is a sad thing, whoever you support, I think.
It's very sad for him. I think the circumstances of the injury play into that as well.
Yes.
The fact that it was in a Merseyside derby, the fact that it was a really... Do I believe there was intent? Who knows? You can't read people's minds. But it was a stupidly rash challenge from Pickford.
Can I chip in there? I mean, to me, it just looks like Jordan Pickford's clumsiness. He did almost exactly the same thing to Dele Alli last season, season before maybe. He is just a bit sort of, I mean, when he comes out in that kind of position, his limbs go everywhere.
I don't think that Pickford intended to hurt him. Absolutely, I don't. But I do think, yes, Pickford is a clumsy goalkeeper and his decision-making is poor. But I also do think that he is an unduly aggressive goalkeeper in the way that he comes out for stuff. And I think that that's where the element of recklessness comes in. That it's not just clumsiness. Like he puts himself into those positions with a degree of frequency that I think is not just clumsiness.
That I agree with. I mean, it's interesting if you trace that back. I think the root for that is probably his lack of size. I mean, he's not small, but compared to someone like Thibaut Courtois, for instance, he is on the shorter side. I mean, in terms of build, if you stand in front of him in a mixed zone or whatever, you're struck by he's not that imposing. And so I think the natural compensation for that for a goalkeeper is to be quite aggressive. If you watch him, for instance, if you watch him try and punch a cross out of his 6-yard box, the way he attacks the ball is, as Alex says, it's full of aggression. And I think this is kind of a manifestation of that general attitude. Like you're trying to make up for what you don't have by being a little bit more physically imposing with your sort of, technical behaviours. And it just seemed to be a consequence of that. I mean, I've seen some really stupid things written about this and the thing about, Pickford should be banned for as long as it takes Virgil van Dijk to... How can you credibly say something like that if you've ever spent any time around the game? Like, you've got some really serious people saying things like that. It's embarrassing.
That was Julien Laurence, wasn't it?
Yeah, yeah. I like him, but I think he'd probably take that one back if he had the chance. I think that's an emotional reaction to something, and maybe he recorded it too soon after the derby. We all have our bad moments. We've all said stupid stuff, but you cannot, I don't think that's particularly helpful when something like this happens.
There was also an interesting thing I saw on Twitter, which is an unusual statement, granted, about contrasting...
Is that the enjoyment or the Twitter bit? Is that the...
Both. contrasting the reaction to this injury with a number of tackles that actually it was Arsenal players had suffered, the Eduardo leg break, the Ramsey leg break, and another tackle on Ramsey, that were much less critical of the player, even though the resulting injuries were worse, and arguably the challenges were worse as well, certainly with the Ramsey leg break. But it seems like the reaction is sort of stoking itself. And again, I think this is a function of social media. This is not to say that the injury isn't really unfortunate and it's very sad for Virgil van Dijk, and I can understand that it's sad for Liverpool fans. But it does seem like we now exist in a kind of response-orientated
It's the platform.
Social-driven way.
It's like the opportunity, because I've done this before, not on Twitter, but like I've watched games of football and felt like personally slighted by something that an opposition team player has done. And then I've genuinely held that anger in me for 48 hours until I watch it back 6 months later and realize that, oh, it was an accident, wasn't it? Or it was a good goal. Or, you know, not even bad tackles. Just the way that a team, opposition team, celebrates a goal is as a smug slight on me. They are somehow telling me that I'm an idiot and that they're way better, even though they're not. Like, it's just stupid. And now there's a thing on your phone that means you can tell the entire world about your immediate irrational response to something, which is what we all have to remember. This is kind of what I was, you know, full circle, which is good because we do have to end the episode. Football makes people irrational, which is great because that's the only point. So, like, do it, but just be careful about doing it on the internet, or when you see it on the internet, not you, Alex, just the listener, when you see it on the internet, just be compassionate, because people are thick. You know, everyone's thick. That's how people work. Everybody is thick, and everyone does thick things all the time. And ultimately, as Mother said to me, it doesn't matter, you're going to die. Anyway, that's the end of the episode now. Thanks so much for listening and downloading. Hopefully you'll spend your remaining years with us and keep downloading every Tuesday and Thursday. And of course, we release on the TIFO Football YouTube channel weekdays as well. So hopefully you can enjoy us there also. And of course, visit theathletic.com/TIFO. To receive, I forgot to say how much it was before. At the moment, I believe it's £1 a month as part of an introductory offer. So please go and do that. Seb, thank you.
Thank you very much, Joe.
Alex, thank you.
Cheers, Joe.
Au revoir.
As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10. Place your first bet on any game and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY 467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.